With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to All Stats Aren't We, a podcast in which Leeds fans cast their combined eye over goings-on at Elland Road, giving scrutiny to the underlying statistics and tactical footings at work at Leeds United. I'm John McKenzie, the Alexander Mitrovic of the podcast, overweight, looking 10 years older than his actual age, and largely detrimental to the team. And I'm joined by the Joey Bryan free kick of the podcast, Tom Woodhead, 0.04xG, completely ridiculous and entirely appropriate for the occasion. And finally, the Scott Parker of the podcast, with no obvious plan, but lucking his way through in the end. It's only Darren Driver. Darren, how you doing?
Scotty Parker. Yeah, I'm all right, thank you. I'm looking forward to my young English manager plaudits in that case. Good. I've not thought about football at all, really, since the last time I was on this podcast, so it'd be interesting to see what I can remember about the game today.
So you're going to be talking about snooker a lot?
I've been talking about snooker a lot, yeah.
And Tom, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. It's only in the world of football management where you can be called young at the age of about 43, isn't it?
Yeah, it's mad.
I'm 40, thank you.
In terms of the football, it seems weird, doesn't it? Because a lot of what we're talking about today, we're doing a season review for those of you who don't know, seems such a long time ago. But even Leeds playing seems such a long time ago, which is made even more crazy by the fact that the Championship has only just officially finished. And as the intro makes reference to, Fulham did win the playoff final yesterday and will be joining us in the Premier League next season. Anyone want to talk about the playoff final at all? Because it was a largely uninspiring match until extra time. I think largely Leeds fans were quite pleased that Brentford lost. But, you know, pick your comedy villain. I think Thomas Frank versus Scott Parker is a pretty close run thing either way. But anyone got any thoughts on the playoff final?
I didn't watch it. I watched the snooker instead.
You probably had a better experience as well.
I did. It was a really good match.
I quite enjoyed extra time, and I really, really enjoyed that Joe Bryan goal. A lot of people were very harsh on Raya for his positioning, but I just thought it was brilliantly done, really. I've really disliked Parker all season, but I quite warmed to him after the game because he was sort of understatedly and quietly emotional, and it just seemed quite sweet, really. Actually, I know it's not the kind of sentiment that Leeds fans necessarily want to hear, but that's how I felt about it.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, it's been a shame for Brentford to not have the chance. Well, they've had the chance of going up, but to not actually have the chance of playing in the Premier League, because it feels as though, you know, there's such a, I guess, intelligent approach to football from them. They have a project. They sort of very carefully have to manage their squads, and they know that if it doesn't work out like it didn't last yesterday, they'd end up breaking up their squad and having to start again and go into another 3-year cycle. Whereas for Fulham, it feels like the complete opposite, where they've sort of lucked their way through, and there's huge problems in their squad build up, but they can get through simply by having vastly superior economic backing, and obviously parachute payments as well. So in many respects, I think it's the sort of result that I suppose a podcast like ours, which does try to celebrate the more cerebral side of the game, shouldn't be feeling good about. But I think a lot of Leeds fans as well will be looking at Fulham and thinking the situation that they're in means that they're probably going to be up there, or down there, I suppose, at the bottom of the table by the end of next season. So any thoughts on Fulham in the Premier League, Darren?
Yeah, I think they're likely to struggle much as they did before. I wonder whether they've learned any lessons from their previous spell up there and whether they'll do the same again and throw loads of money at it in a kind of fairly haphazard way. So I think it'd be interesting to see how Parker copes and what happens to his reputation next season, because I think they're likely to get mullered in quite an unpleasant way again personally, but we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird one, but it feels to me like they need to bin off Mitrovic, despite how good he is in certain ways. You could see last night when they were attacking before Mitrovic came on, their overall play was probably better than it is with Mitrovic in the team, and I think he feels kind of out of step with everything else they're trying to do. A lot of people say Leeds should be signing Ollie Watkins, and that'd obviously be a great transfer for a lot of clubs in the Premier League, but I think Fulham would probably be looking at him as well, because I think he'd massively improve their attack in terms of the coherence of it and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of teams will be looking at Ollie Watkins right now. But
absolutely. I was just going to say that I think Mitrovic's limitations are as obvious as his strengths, and his limitations mean that you need to build your team around him in such a way that actually does limit the rest of the kind of build-up play and the things that you can do with your front line in the way that Tom refers to.
I was actually staggered by the fact that they don't seem to have another proper striker other than Mitrovic in their squad, which I know we talk about Leeds, but Leeds have tried to solve that problem all year by getting Nketiah in and then getting Augustin in. We at least tried to solve it, whereas it seems like Fulham have not really even tried, unless there's some player that I don't really know about.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure of the ins and outs of their squads, but they've sort of tried to play a fairly fluid front three whenever they've not had Mitrovic, haven't they? And I think it's largely worked, but I mean, it's something that we've talked about before, I think, but so much of what Fulham do is described as patient build-up, and I think that comes down to the fact that in transition they're essentially relying on, well, Mitrovic doesn't really do much. He's a sort of fulcrum that you can sort of hit the ball long to and try and use him as someone who's going to knock down to the other players. But in terms of your actual patient possession build-up, it just doesn't really work for them, because he's just always going to be off the pace, and that means you're essentially doing your transition work with 10 players rather than 11. And I think it's been so painfully obvious this season that's been the case for them, that I think there's a lot of people who maybe think that Fulham have been quite lucky to even have the chance to be in the Premier League this season. But I'm sure it's something that they will fix this season. They've also got a lot of good players coming back on loan, I think. So Anguissa, I can't remember where he's been playing, but he's been playing somewhere on the continent. And Jean-Michel Seri as well is coming back for them too. Both very good players, and you only think that they could be decent additions to that team as well. So yeah, it's going to be pretty interesting seeing what their trajectory is going to be, because part of me thinks that, you know, if they hadn't have made it, they would probably have moved Scott Parker on. They'd have rethought their project through. They would have thought their squad through, and they would probably start building for the future. Whereas now it just sort of feels as though they're going to drag on for another season, then maybe go down again, and then maybe go through the whole process again until they finally get to a situation where they're not constantly yo-yoing between the two leagues. But I guess we'll see about that. News this week, there's really very, very little to talk about. Graham Smith has just released news that Kun Temenjukov has just been sent on loan to Segunda B-side Real Union, which that's about as exciting as it gets, unfortunately, in the transfer market at the moment. There is news that there will be an AGM on Thursday at the club, which is going to involve a discussion about what the club's response to COVID is going to be and how that's going to change their approach in the transfer market. And I suspect that Bielsa will be announced around then, or maybe the end of the week, and then we'll start seeing some sort of activity in the transfer market. So that's sort of where we're at. But all the boring transfer window stuff aside, this is the first part of our season review, which I think we all feel a little bit underprepared for. partly because it's kind of hard to know how to do a season review. And I think the beginning of this episode should be talking about how do you even do a season review, how we would divide things up. So we've decided today to go up to the Cardiff 3-3 draw at Elland Road, because that feels like quite an important turning point in the season. But between that, so that's the, I think that's the 22nd match day of the Championship. We had two EFL, League Cup, sorry, games in that period as well. So those are the games that we're going to talk about today. Let's just begin by talking about how you might divide up the season. I've had a sort of rough go at it, but it's really not worked out particularly well in terms of neat and tidy cut. So I'll just run through the way that I've divided the season up in my head. And then we can maybe talk about how we might do it differently, or what other divisions that we might do. So we're going to talk a little bit about the preseason and what we were expecting before the season kicked off, and the players that went in and out. Then I've got what I've described as the foreshore years, predictably. So the games that we played until foreshore got injured, which finished with the sixth match day of the Championship, which was against Swansea. Then we had what I've described as actually a bit of a minor blip, where we sort of came off the rails a little bit. We had losses against Charlton and Millwall, and that famous draw against Derby, but that was balanced off by a decent result against West Brom, which maybe didn't feel decent at the time in terms of the way we played, but was still, I think, quite important. And then I've got sort of a long patch of games where I've called it the back three strikes back, but because we ended up playing the 3-3-1-3 quite a lot in this period. So I've got it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times in about 10 games. So we for some reason, we started playing the back three quite a lot. Now, a lot of the teams we played against played two strikers, which is essentially the reason why we did it. But it did sort of turn around that minor blip, and it precipitated a fairly decent run of results. So this is match day 12 to match day 21, which is just before the Cardiff game. And in that time, we dropped 4 points in two draws early on, match days 13 and 14 against Preston North End and Sheffield Wednesday. Apart from that, we won every single game. And weirdly, even at the end of that run, by match day 21, we still weren't top of the table, which we didn't actually achieve until the following match day, which was against Cardiff City, where we ended up taking a 3-0 result to 3-3, and that's what I've called the turning point. Now, that's this the back three strikes back section is quite a lot of games, so it's match day 12 to match day 21, and I guess the big question is how you might split that run of games in two. But anyone want to jump in with thoughts about how I've split up the season and suggestions that maybe a better division?
It seems like the logical way to do it to me. I don't think there's an obvious better way to do it. Because, I mean, splitting up that big run of games that you were just talking about, I mean, they do feel like one thing to me. And it did feel like a sustained run that was sort of it didn't feel like we were overwhelmingly great during that one run, but we just kept winning. And that was that was the theme of that.
Yeah, that's interesting, because to me, my kind of emotional memory of the Preston North End draw and the Wednesday game were that we were actually quite poor in both of those games.
The Wednesday game, definitely, I think, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But I sort of think that being promoted from the Championship, it must be predicated on how many runs of 5 to 6 wins you can put together. And I think for me, that run of 7 wins just before the Cardiff game was actually what broke the back of the season in a lot of different ways. So I'd kind of put that apart, that 7-game run. But other than that, I think you've kind of more or less divided it up in a way which fits in with how I'd have done it.
Because I think after that point, we don't drop out of the top two at all. I'm pretty sure that's true, yeah.
No, we
so
don't.
The last time we're outside the top two was match day 17, where we beat Luton. There's some really weird, yeah. We beat Luton and went from third to second, and from that point on, we were never outside the top two. Interestingly, you mentioned the runs of wins, because there's obviously that run of wins just before lockdown happens as well, and that involves similar sorts of teams. So in my head, thinking back over the season, I have to sort of make an effort to distinguish between those two. I mean, they're slightly different. There's Bristol City's in there, but you've still got teams like Reading, Middlesbrough, Hull City, and Huddersfield. And in many respects, you know, those were the sorts of teams that we did well against. I think in many respects, the story of this season was that we beat the teams that we were expected to beat. a lot more than we did last season. Although having said that, as we're going to talk about, you know, it did feel as though there were quite a lot of results in the, at least in that first half as well, where we, when we dropped points, we either didn't deserve it or we were sort of the victims of unfortunate circumstances. So you got the Charlton loss, which was that sort of freak own goal off Stuart Dallas, and when Macaulay Bond sort of hit it straight at Kiko and he palmed it into Dallas, and then we just couldn't break them down. They just sat deep and we didn't break them down well enough. And then you've got the Millwall game where there's the red card for Berardi in 14 yeah. minutes, I think. The Swansea game where we dominated them and they just sort of scabbed that goal at the end. There's the Forest game where we were on top for most of the game and they scabbed a goal in that. There's the Derby result where we, again, dominated and they got that goal with pretty much their only shot on target in like the 89th minute as well. And so I wondered if you guys thought that we've cut off at Cardiff, because I do feel as though it was a turning point. Was the season before Cardiff relatively comfortable for us, and why do you think, what impact do you think the Cardiff game had on the games that came after that? Because it was really after the Cardiff game that we really had our major blip, and up until that Nottingham Forest game, which I think will be the second turning point in the next episode, that was really the moment at which it felt to me that had we not given away that 3-0 lead against Cardiff, we may well have just walked the league in a way that we didn't otherwise.
Yeah, I totally agree. I felt like right up until the 70th minute of that Cardiff game, I was certain that we were going to continue kind of being really strong and to push right through it. But I felt that the way that we kind of collapsed in that game really kind of made the players feel a pressure that they hadn't necessarily felt up until that point of the season. I have to say that up until that point where we went on that 7-game winning run, my feeling was that we were just bubbling under, really, that we weren't quite meeting the two points per game that you needed, and that the season could really have still gone either way. Despite the fact that we were controlling large portions of games, I still felt that we were kind of bubbling under in terms of results, and I was a bit worried that we were in for a repeat of last season, but without necessarily the kind of spectacular elements of it that we'd had the year before.
Yeah, I felt like the first sort of 10-15 games of the season or so, they're very different looking back than they felt at the time, because I think everyone was still a little bit scarred by, you know, last season and by the playoffs. And games like, for example, Nottingham Forest, the second game of the season, if you look back on it, that was a game that we dominated. We actually created quite a lot of chances and we, you know, easily deserved to win. But at the time, it felt more like, oh, here we go again, Leeds.
Yeah.
You know, letting in a soft goal towards the end, and I can't remember exactly when that goal was scored, actually, but it was, it felt like kind of, and the Derby one especially, where we absolutely dominated them and Click missed a penalty, and then they, yeah, as you say, they got a goal with their only shot, basically. So it felt, everything felt a bit more suffused with weird meanings in that first 10 or 15 games, I think. And then, as Darren says, I think when we hit that 7-game winning run, a lot of those feelings started to disappear, I think. And then obviously Cardiff happened, and you know, it wasn't that long after Cardiff happened that the Birmingham game happened, which I don't think the Birmingham game would have happened if the Cardiff game, obviously it would have happened, but I don't think the Birmingham game would have played out the same way if we hadn't had that collapse against Cardiff.
Mm. I also think that, you know, as with all of our winning streaks, that it's easy to look back on them on paper and sort of see them as wins and sort of move on. But for example, the Luton game, we really dragged that one out. The Reading game came out of nowhere right at the end as well. Obviously, we had the Middlesbrough 4-0, which was a nice respite, but the Huddersfield 2-0 was hard,
really
work.
Tough. Yeah,
they really made us work hard in that game as well. So yeah, I think it's important to remember as well that, you know, a lot of these results were, I mean, there's other games as well. I'm just looking back and now the Barnsley game where we won 2-0, again, that looks a lot more comfortable on paper than it really was. The West Brom game was stressful as anything.
Yeah.
The Birmingham Centenary game was, again, that was hard work too. So it's an interesting one, because I think for me, it felt as though this season we like, I think you've said bubbling away. I feel like we were on the cusp of just being really quite good this season, and it just never really happened, and it felt like we did everything just slightly the hardest way possible. Now I'm obviously going to say that the loss of Forshaw was big in that, but do you think there's any other reasons why we sort of seemed like we were on the cusp of brilliance, but we never really had a sort of run of games where we just blew everyone away game after game?
I think largely it's to do with the way that teams set up to play against us. Very, very often sitting back deep, soaking up pressure. Although we make a lot of chances in those types of games, it's actually very difficult to look good in those types of games, I think. So I think that's partly to do with it. I think I'm trying to remember when Pablo started kind of struggling with his hamstring. I think that probably contributed a little bit, although I think that largely happened after the Cardiff game. I think you're right. I think Forshaw not being in there and having to kind of rethink the way that the midfield operated, having to rethink the way that the wings operated on the right-hand side particularly really made a difference in that period too.
I just looked it up, Darren, and Pablo basically was out from the Charlton game to the Sheffield Wednesday game. So it really did basically coincide with our little mini blip.
Yeah, I thought so. Thanks.
One thing I found quite interesting was if you look at that winning run of seven games, they're mostly against teams from mid-table to the bottom half that try and play football. QPR, Blackburn, Luton, maybe not quite so much, but Reading, Middlesbrough at the time. And Hull are all, you know, teams that try and play, and they're the teams that we're best against, I think, teams that aren't very good that try and play.
I think that version of Luton earlier in the season was much more open than the Nathan Jones version towards the end, if my memory is correct.
I think as well the fact that we played, I think, because it was in November, we basically only really played, we played maybe two games out of five where we didn't, or six where we didn't have we didn't have the back three, and we didn't have that sort of run of playing the 3-3-1-3 for the rest of the season. And that's not because teams weren't playing two strikers against us. They definitely were. But I think the teams were much more likely in the second half of the season to sit deep against us, because I think they'd seen that seven-game run where they were like, we'll go out and play how we usually play. We'll play some sort of variation of either a 4-4-2 with or without a diamond, or a 4-4-1-1, or a 3-5-2. And teams just got punished against us. And I think in the second half of the season, teams were a lot less likely to do that kind of approach against us. And that's why, you know, we sort of laboured a little bit more against
it.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, look, it's easy to forget, and we shouldn't talk too much about this, but I think, because it will be in the next episode, but we really are maybe misunderestimating just how much a blip we had after the Cardiff game, because the results really are quite poor until we go until we get to Nottingham Forest, and then it's sort of turned back around. And if you look at the run of results from Forest onwards, I mean from Brentford onwards, it's literally that one fluke result against Cardiff and then the fluke result against Luton, and that's basically it. Everything else we sort of powered our way home to the end of the season. So I do think that sort of ties in with the notion that Cardiff actually hit us for six in a way, because I think in Cardiff, the Cardiff game was really like the first, as you've mentioned, the first time that those sort of psychological demons really hit. I think in other games, you know, yes, there were results that were disappointing where you kind of think we've dominated this game, but we've ended up not getting all the points. But I think that game was sort of like, if you can get a 3-0 lead and then throw it away, you're never going to be able to dominate enough to feel safe. Yeah. And I think that had a huge psychological impact on us. And I guess the end of the season was very much about sort of ameliorating that and putting it behind us. But we're at a risk of talking about the next section. So let's go back and talk about the pre-season. So obviously there's a few things we can talk about here. There's a number of games that were played, which I don't know how important they are. I think a lot of people sort of rely on the sort of Cagliari game as an important one, and I'm not sure why, other than in that game we played the 3-3-1-3 and the sort of iteration that we played it in the season, and we looked quite good, and obviously there was the Leif Davis situation.
For me, the reason that the Cagliari game is important is because I think, if my memory serves correctly, it's the game where I realised that Ben White was absolutely class and that we didn't need to worry about the centre-half position.
Right.
The thing I found interesting about that Calgary game was that, if I remember correctly, Forshaw was essentially playing the position that we saw Dallas play a few times this season. I don't think we ever actually saw Forshaw play that position in the regular season in the end, but because he got injured, obviously. But he was playing that sort of wing black slash midfield role. Where he, you know, he went over to the right when we're in possession and then covered on the left out of possession. I think it's that way around. But that was really interesting to me at the time, and that's why I thought it was worth flagging it up.
I do think that's important. And I think, you know, a lot of the story of this season has been, and we've said this before, has been about Bielsa being happy to make tactical changes in the way that he wasn't in the first season. So it's about him feeling comfortable enough to play players who can give him that degree of tactical flexibility. Other than that, the games that we had in pre-season were against York, Guiseley, Manchester United, Tadcaster Albion, Western Sydney Wanderers. Then we had a behind-closed-door games against Al Ittihad, which, as far as any of the fans are concerned, didn't happen because we have no idea what happened. And then there's a game against Girona as well, which I've completely forgotten about. What were the thoughts from what were your sort of overriding thoughts from pre-season? Because I think there was probably a certain amount of nervousness that we had actually the same sort of sense of in the pre-season the year before, where we had no idea what to expect from Bielsa. And actually, what I thought so interesting about the original pre-season under Bielsa was that we played sort of fairly stodgy, uninspiring football until the Las Palmas game, where largely Bielsa had been experimenting with formations, and then he sort of settled on, this is roughly the sort of formation that we're going to play in the championship, and it looked amazing. I still look back on that last part. I was at the game and just remember sitting there thinking, like, this is incredible. I never thought we would see football like this being played at Elland Road. How would you say that the this season's preseason sort of mirrored that? Was it as much experimental? I mean, for me, the big game that stood out really was the Manchester United one, because I thought it might be a fairly good sense of just how far we'd come, and it really wasn't that inspiring a game.
Yeah, they were much further ahead of us in their preparation, as I recall. I think they'd done a few more weeks, so I didn't really read anything into that as a thing. In fact, I tend not to really think about the games during pre-season or the results or even the performances, but just, you know, like, was looking for those tactical developments like you were talking about. So I, like, you know, looked at Forshaw. I was looking for the sort of player that Ben White was. I was looking to see, you know, whether Kiko Kassir could become a good goalkeeper suddenly after the derby, the derby aberration the previous season. So it was more things along that sort of lines that I was looking for, really. But I kind of still felt that by the time we got to the Bristol game, I didn't really feel like I had any real idea about what the season was likely to look like. I didn't feel any more certain at all.
I always find a pre-season quite interesting under Bielsa. Well, I have done the past 2 years, just because he'll do really weird things, and the things that he does in pre-season are almost like a caricature of how people talk about Bielsa. You know, like, I remember the first pre-season he was playing Click as a centre-back in the middle of a three, and things like that. No, there wasn't quite so much of that this year, but I think there was less room for it as well, because only about half the squad went to Australia. So, you know, Bielsa was obviously not happy about the Australian trip altogether. He stayed back in the UK, didn't he, with people like Costa, trying to get them up to speed, and then only flew out for the games. So it was a bit of a weird pre-season in that regard. And the Manchester United game in general was just a bizarre event, with all fireworks and flamethrowers and, you know, neon lighting everywhere. It was a really weird thing to watch. But we did some good things against Man United in the first half as well, but I think it became very obvious that they were way fitter than us further along in their preparations in the second half.
And I think there's a few players that we didn't have, because it was just simply because of fitness, wasn't it? I think the reason why players like Costa and did Janssen not go for some reason?
Janssen was already gone by that point, I think.
Yeah, he was.
But Ben White didn't go, I don't think. Ben White stayed behind. Basically stayed behind
because they weren't fit enough, essentially, and he wanted to stay and work with them, in terms of the ins and outs, so you've already mentioned that Pontus had already gone by that point. Kemar Roofe left as well. Those are the two big transfers out. How do we look back on those two transfers at the time, and how do we look back at them now, Tom?
That was another interesting thing about pre-season, actually, is that Bielsa seemed quite set on using Roof as a sort of number 10 behind Bamford. I think every single game while Roof was still here, he started him in that position. So I don't think Bielsa was particularly planning on selling Bamford Roof. Obviously, but then 7 million for a player who's only got 1 year left on his contract, I think most people sort of accepted it at the time, and I certainly thought it seemed like good money for Roof at the time.
Yeah, I was never asked about Roof going. I never kind of particularly rated him, to be honest. I always felt he looked busy without any great impact, given, albeit he did score a number of goals in that first season. But yeah, I was a bit worried because in the previous season I'd felt we were a centre back short all the way through the season, and I was tiring of the Pontus Janssen show, like some people were. I know that there were mixed views on that. So I felt that Ben White coming in was great, and seeing him in that friendly was great. But I also did feel that we needed a Pontus replacement as well as Ben White. And obviously I've been proved wrong in the long term, but I still feel we might have been a bit lucky with injuries in that part of the team throughout the season to kind of get away with that number of players. I think Jack Clark went as well, and Bailey Peacock Farrell went to Burnley. And my overriding feeling about that, you know, in hindsight, is that we've had both of their pants down for those two players, and I'm quite happy with it.
And then in terms of incomings, then obviously Helder Costa, we brought in Eddie Nketiah, I think quite late. Did we bring him in quite late?
Yeah, it was late, yeah.
Because we had to do all of that preparation on showing him PowerPoint slides and stuff. And Ilan Meslier as well came in too, which obviously Darren is going to wax lyrical about. But thoughts on the incomings, Darren?
Yeah, I mean, because we're only covering the first half of the season, I've not got a lot to say about Meslier, except that I saw him in a few 23s games and he looked great. And that was where I decided that he was going to be one of the best keepers in the world one day. but other than that, yeah. Yeah, obviously we were all excited about Costa coming in, and thought we were getting one sort of player, and I think actually in the event we've got a slightly different type of player than the one we thought we were getting. But I think he is someone that's growing into his time at Leeds, and I think he'll be even better next year. So I was excited to see him come in. I was excited for Nketiah, because it's always nice to see, you know, players from a allegedly top Premier League club come down and play in the Championship. Whether it worked out or not, I guess is a different matter in the end. But at the start of the season, I was excited to see Costa and Nketiah in and around the team together, for sure.
Let's talk a little bit about Nketiah at this point, because it's probably a good time to talk about him, because we largely had him in the first half of the season and that was it. Tom, what's your takeaway on the Nketiah situation?
I thought he basically did as well as could be expected coming off the bench most of the times he came off the bench. He changed games for us. He won us a few extra points. I think there's something to be said for in these Bielsa teams having a sort of go-to substitution. Like, things always seem a bit more comfortable when we've got one. The season before, we had Jack Clark for that period where Jack Clark was coming on at half-time most games and changing things. And towards the end of this season, we had Pablo coming on at half-time and changing things. And Nketiah sort of filled that role for the first half of the season. It was nice to know that we had a player that we knew was capable of sort of changing the timbre and the tempo of the game on the bench, ready to come on. And yeah, he did score some crucial goals for us and made an impact. I was not particularly impressed any of the times that I saw him start, but if he'd have been happy to stay for the second half of the season and play the same role, I think we would have probably broken 100 points barrier, to be honest.
Do you think it was a style thing with Nketiah that he didn't work out?
I think so. I think he was getting better all the time, and I think he would have continued to get better. So it's possible that he may have eventually adjusted.
Yeah, I think when I rewatched the Cardiff home game, just before we played Cardiff at the start of after post lockdown games, I did notice that when Nketiah replaced Bamford in that game, our defensive structure completely fell apart, and the way that we pressed completely changed. And he was quite ineffective in that role. Although he was good for stretching the Cardiff defence and got one of their players sent off and all that kind of thing. So in the end, you know, he's not a like-for-like replacement for Bamford, and I think we were trying to make him operate in that way. And I'm not sure it would have ever really worked out in that particular way, to be honest. I think if there were times when it was good that we had them both on the pitch, and that worked at times. But as a replacement, I don't really feel he kind of cut the mustard in that role.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Right, so let's move on to the different divisions that we've made in the season. So the first one that I've called the Forshaw years until Forshaw's injury on I think it came off the back of his game against Swansea. I think he played the full game, but picked up the injury during that game, and that was it. Him done for the whole season.
I think he was struggling with that injury in pre-season, you know, John, from what I've heard. Right. I think it was something that he carried through those first few games.
Yeah. It would make sense because he did end up having to take a surgery for it, and I guess that means that there was some kind of structural issue that was constantly nagging in him. Because he did actually come on in the Cardiff game, the Charlton game in the second half, after we were already 1-0 down, and that was basically that was the beginning of the end, and the saga then became, oh, will he get back to fitness just on his own? And it just kind of kept dragging and dragging and dragging until they got to a point where he was like, look, I'm gonna have to do something about this now, because otherwise it's going to go on yeah. longer as well. But so we've got the games against Bristol City win, then the draw against Forest with that lucky goal, then wins against Wigan, Brentford, which was an important win, I think, especially because Brentford, I think, had they not had a bad start to the season, would have probably gone up automatically. And then the Stoke City game, which is probably the pinnacle of Leeds under Bielsa. Again, I'm probably biased in saying that. Before the Swansea game, where we, again, dominated but conceded a goal late on. This was a period that we talked about a lot on the podcast in terms of control. And you've suggested, I think, Darren, that maybe we were too controlled, or at least we controlled without any sort of real punch. How do you look back on this period where, if you actually look back on the XG plot, the rolling XG plot, we were just producing way more XG than we did for the rest of the season, and we were conceding way less XG than we were for the rest of the season. How do you look on this period where we sort of maybe had our strongest-ish team?
Yeah, no, with kind of, I really do enjoy watching games from that period of time. I really enjoy watching the opening game against Bristol. The Stoke away game I've watched on numerous occasions. So I wouldn't say that I feel that we didn't have punch. It's just that the results weren't quite going for us, I think, is what I would say. I thought we were absolutely fantastic in that period. And I guess the reason for that, I've been thinking about it a little bit. I know that I've said many times that I like Pablo on the right instead of in the middle. Actually, what I like is Pablo being able to move into the middle with the control behind him of Forshaw and Click, really keeping things solid for us and giving Pablo that kind of space to play. And giving Pablo opportunity to move into gaps without necessarily thinking about who's running in behind him and what his defensive responsibilities are. So, yeah, we were fantastic in that first part of the season, although there were times when the results didn't quite go for us. The Swansea home game, the Forest home game, and perhaps our home form as a full thing wasn't quite was a problem that needed to be solved in that first part of the season as well.
I would just echo a lot of what Darren said, but I think I would add, adding to that home thing, the atmosphere at Elland Road for a lot of the first half of the season was quite poisonous in whenever it looks like we might not win. Whenever it got to the point where you know, we were trying to get a goal after 70 minutes, or, you know, the other team scored at any point, and it would get very, very tense. And people would start, you know, talking about, oh, they're doing it again, we're throwing it away. And it and I think that probably did get to the players at times. So I think you've got to give credit to them for, you know, ploughing through that and, you know, and putting it behind them.
It's almost like one of those relationships where people break up and then get back together, but then, which is all well and good until someone starts bringing up things that have happened in the past. That's how it felt very much to me. It was sort of as soon as, and again, that sort of culminates in the Cardiff victory, where it was like, see, you always say this and then you end up doing that.
But, you always do this. Just fucking shoot.
Well, there was the Derby game especially. I was stood right next to one of the most negative people I've ever encountered at Elland Road, who was just moaning throughout the entire game when we were playing incredibly, and me and my mate we were talking to him saying, are you not enjoying this? Is this not good? And then, of course, that has to be the game where we do actually let it slip at the end, and he, you know, yeah, he had the last laugh.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of my friends actually who would say that they didn't enjoy this season as much as last season. And I think a lot of that was to do with the weight of expectation, where we were expecting the team to win every game. And even when you then go and win that game, your weight of expectation then shifts to the next game. And it's just the whole time being in that tension of being like, we always have to be at our best all the time. We can't really let anything slip, because if we let anything slip, we need to have a 10-point gap by the end, or we're not gonna make it. We are not gonna win those games at the end of the season. We threw away all of these points at the end of last year, etc. And it just added to, I think, maybe the stress of the appearances. And I think as well, with the fact that, like you said, we were dominating games and still not coming through, it that just puts a whole level of added pressure on fans, I think, because and again, culminating in the Cardiff game, where you think, well, if we can dominate games, be 3-0 up, and then still manage to confect a drop of points, then you don't feel comfortable at all as a fan, because you can never be like, yeah, look, we've not given away a 2-goal lead this season, we'll be fine. You're still thinking, yeah, look, we've given away a 3-goal lead, and that dragged on. I wondered if we could do a quick pop quiz for the two of you. Do you think you could name the team that went out against Bristol City in the first game of the season?
Oh, Jesus.
I reckon I could, yeah. Definitely.
Go on then, Tom.
Right. Douglas at left back, Cooper, White, Dallas.
Yeah.
Phillips, Forshaw, Harrison, Click, Pablo, Bamford, and Kassir in net.
Yeah, perfect. So the reason I've said that is because actually a player that we've not talked about is Luke Ayling, who didn't start until fairly deep in the season. He didn't come on until match day 10. So he was out until past the Charlton game. And that sort of coincides, I think, fairly well with Forshaw not being in the team as well. So I guess my question is, how good would we have been if we'd have had Ayling available at the beginning of the season as well?
I think we would have been even more controlling, actually, because I think Ayling uses the ball better than Dallas does on the whole. And Dallas is decent enough at getting forward and getting crosses in and working hard, but I think Ayling uses the ball more intelligently, and that would have made us even better, I think. Hmm.
But we might not have had that beautiful Stoke goal, so I'm quite happy to forgive Dallas giving the ball away a few times for that.
Oh yeah, but imagine if Ayling have scored that. Imagine the celebration and him going on about it every week. It would have been even better.
That is true. That is true.
Yeah. Is there anything else from this sort of period that you want to talk about? So I guess we could. So we've got the Brentford game. I think stands out. The Stoke game is obviously, as I think, was maybe the pinnacle of Bielsa-ism at Leeds.
I think going from Stoke away winning 3-0 and then battering Swansea the following week and not managing to get even a point out of it is peak Bielsa at Leeds.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and we should talk about the AFL Cup as well, because there was the game against Salford, which was quite an interesting one. I think we actually played a 3-5-2 in that game as well, which is it's not showed up on Transfermarkt, but it was definitely an interesting one. I'm just gonna have a look at the lineup now, because I can't even remember who we played.
We played a lot of young players, I remember that.
Yeah, this is the first instance, I think, of...
Did Nketiah start?
Yeah.
Nketiah did start, yeah. And Costa started as well. Yeah. Shackleton played. Jack Clark started. Leif Davis played as I think, an outside centre-back in a back three.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Alioski as the wing-back.
Click plays.
Click plays,
McCalmont played, didn't he?
McCalmont came on. Jack Harrison came on and Patrick Bamford came on. I think maybe that was when we went to the 3-5-2. Maybe when Bamford came on, I think we then pushed them to two strikers. And that was a fun outing, that one. It was obviously a game against Adam Rooney as well, who had just signed for huge amounts of money.
And it was all the class of 92 talk, wasn't it, as well?
And then obviously we had the I mean, maybe this is the peak Bielsaism, going from Stoke City away 3-0 and then losing 6-7 on pens at home in like 2 or 3 days later. But takeaways from the EFL Cup, because we were, I think in the Carabao Cup, we were quite pleased to be out of it, really. But anything more notable to say about the EFL Cup?
Well, the only thing I like to say is I'd quite like to see us go for one of these cups next season. Why not? Like, you know, we'll be playing fewer games anyway. I'd quite like to see us go for both cups, like Bielsa did when he was at Bilbao. It'd just be nice to at least have a try.
Yeah, the only other takeaway that I've got from it is that Jack Harrison missing a penalty in the second round game against Stoke seemed to be what cemented his relationship with the Leeds fans in a positive way, really bizarrely, because people were singing him off the pitch because he played quite well in the game. And I think that kind of, it was the moment he was accepted once he'd missed a penalty. It's a really strange kind of thing.
So let's move on from there to the sort of minor blip, which I guess really does begin with perhaps the Swansea game. And again, you see that sort of age-old pattern, which is losing a game which we probably on paper should have, well, in reality should have won. And then that sort of sending us into a bit of a spiral. So the games were a win against Barnsley, which we've already said was maybe a little bit trickier than we thought. A draw with Derby, which was, again, probably some of the best football that we've seen under Bielsa.
We were outstanding. Yeah,
I agree. Yeah.
And then there was that Chris Martin goal in whatever it was, 89th minute or something. And it was, I mean, that was almost like you can't write this sort of stuff, wasn't it? It was incredibly parodic of Leeds, but
And I think that was peak Bamford's missed chances as well. If I remember correctly, in that game there were three or four really, really big chances for him, and that's what I felt people were starting to get on his back more than ever in that game particularly.
And I think that had a knock-on effect as well, because after Click missed that penalty, he stopped taking our penalties again until he took one towards the end of the season. And I think he would have scored every other penalty if he'd taken them all. And Bamford did miss one at one point, didn't he? I can't remember if that cost us points or
QPR
not.
QPR away, yeah. I think so.
Yeah, and that we did lose that game, didn't we? So that cost us points as well. And I'm sure Click would have scored that if he'd have taken it. So that did have a little knock-on effect as well.
Yeah, I think that's a fair one. And then obviously the Charlton result, where again we sort of gave away, and it seemed to be as we were giving away really cheap goals, and then we were just unable to break down oppositions. And then obviously the Millwall game came there as well, which was the red card in the 14th minute, and then we sort of got back into that game at half time, I think, and made it 2-1, but then again couldn't break them down. Obviously between that was the West Brom game, where again that was probably the most tentative game perhaps we've seen under Bielsa until the Barnsley game right at the end of the season. But again, that was a really sort of tetchy period of the season, and I think it all kind of stems back from that first loss of the season, where it was, again, you sort of have this overriding feeling that, you know, we've lucked out this far, we've got results where we needed to, but something's going to happen, something's going to go wrong, and then we'll collapse back into the leads of the last four games of last season.
Sorry, just to briefly touch on that Charlton game again. I did feel like out of the first half of the season, that was possibly the only game that we lost that it felt like to me at the time we sort of deserved to lose. I'm not sure what the underlying numbers and XG and stuff like that said about that game, but I definitely remember thinking, yeah, fair enough. It wasn't like those other games, we didn't do well enough to win that.
I'm just pulling up the numbers now so we can find out, but I do think that's true. And I think there's only a couple of games where we actually deserved to lose per XG. I think one of them was the Millwall game, which I think, you know, there's reasons for that, isn't there? Just trying to see now. Sorry, I've got a really confusing heavy team stats. So the Charlton game, you'll be surprised.
I think we dominated XG in that game, if I remember correctly.
We did. Oh, right. We created 2 XG and we conceded 0.38.
I think this was a game where I watched with like kids and family buzzing around, so it probably says more about my experience watching the game than it does about the actual game itself.
I think I remember a lot of people on our channel afterwards saying, well, we deserve to lose that one. And I think it was because we just sat back, that they sat back after the goal, and we really didn't do much to break them down in terms of, we didn't look like we were dominating in the way that we had in other games. So I think a lot of people just sort of read that way. The Millwall game was one of the games that we lost on XG. I think there was maybe two games. Crazy, isn't it? But I can't remember what the other one was.
But one of those was a penalty, wasn't it, for the Millwall game? There was their penalty to take into the XG.
Right. Yeah. So there is that
penalty which shouldn't have been given.
Yeah. Did he got his red card rescinded as well?
He did. Yeah.
Right?
Which basically never happens as well. So you know it was a major mistake.
Yeah. I'm just looking at the West Brom game as well. We got 1.92 XG to their 0.85. So again, that's a game which we've deserved to win. But I remember at the time looking back on it and thinking, we really was that the one where Bamford scored off Semi Ajayi's shoulder?
No, that was the other game. That was the
What was the first game?
The first, I can't remember who scored, but we did score fairly early, and we were hanging on for a long time in the second half.
It was Alioski with the deflection. The West Brom. We're talking about West Brom.
Yeah.
Alioski with the deflection off Kyle Bartley.
Yeah, because I remember both of the. Oh, so it was off. But the other one was a deflection as well. So both the other
one was an actual own goal, whereas header. I think this one was given to Alioski.
Okay. So yeah, I think again that's another reason why I didn't feel like we necessarily dominated that.
But
game.
We defended absolutely magnificently in the second half of that game. They were never going to get through us.
This was a game where Pat Bamford got a lot of accolades as well, right? The West Brom at home game. Is that right?
I think it's the West Brom away game, isn't it? Maybe both, because he came on at half time in West Brom away. Thor and Kettier, and I think a lot of people saw what he was all about then. It was kind of an obvious comparison, but maybe he got a lot of accolades for the home game as well. I can't remember.
Yeah, he did. I remember his pressing particularly been outstanding in that West Brom game, and I think that was where we saw the first kind of evidence of Warrior Bamford this year. You know, where he really kind of goes out just to scrap, and he's not really bothered about anything else.
There is something about his running style when he really gets into that pressing that just I don't know. His legs are just going everywhere and his arms are pumping like he's pretending to be the T-1000 or something.
He keeps his arms quite low, which makes him look quite funny when he runs, right?
Yeah.
He sort of lollops.
Yeah.
And obviously the way that we press up front as well is by having a player less than their build-up players. And so it means he has to sort of do those sort of long loping, first make sure you close the passing lane down and then press the ball player.
It's a bit like watching kids playing football in the park sometimes, isn't it? Just everyone running after the ball. It's great.
Just as those really long sort of like loping curved runs. And I love it. I don't know if you guys know, but I'm quite a big fan of Pat Bamford.
You should have mentioned it.
Yeah, well, you know, far be it from me to have bugbears. Someone's just deleted something from the...
Sorry, that might have been me by accident.
What are you doing?
That's back, sorry.
That's back. So that's the minor blip. What do we think turns things around after that Millwall game? So you've had that run of games where it's been Leeds have been dominating everyone, and then suddenly you hit Derby draw, Charlton loss, West Brom just about win, Millwall loss, and then we turn things around and have that run of however many games it is. Nine games where, was it 10 games where there's seven wins in a row and then there's a win against Birmingham, two draws. What do you think turned it around? Is it simply the teams that we played against at this point? Because I'm just looking through it now and it's Birmimgham win, Preston draw, Preston the sixth at the time. We got a draw against Sheffield Wednesday, which I think most people would say was a good result given that Sheffield Wednesday were third at this point. And it's crazy to think that Sheffield Wednesday just had that wild run in the middle of the season where they just won everything.
It's not like a Gary Monk team to fall away like that.
It was peak Gary Monk is what it was.
But yeah, and then you've got sort of QPR who were ninth, Blackburn who were 16th, Luton who are 20th, Reading who are 18th, Middlesbrough who are 20th, Huddersfield who are 19th, and then Hull who are 12th, and obviously just about to really dunk it down the pan. So I think that it is worth saying that if you actually look at those results, you know, we did just beat the teams that we needed to beat. And I think that was a sort of testament to this period of the season. But is it simply the case that we were playing against lower, teams who were lower in the table and we just sort of made the most of it?
Yeah, but we don't always do that, do we? You know, in previous seasons, we haven't done that. So I took it as a really strong indicator that that, you know, we were really strong, that we were serious about staying around for the season, that we were making sure that we got the results that we needed. There were some really good performances in there. I remember the first 60 minutes against Blackburn being very strong. Obviously, the Middlesbrough 4-0, you know. So I think that, yeah, we were playing lower-ranked teams, but when they're in front of you, you have to beat them. And we did that, you know, really consistently.
It's probably worth mentioning the Birmingham game as well, because that almost feels like its own thing, because it was a centenary game and
yeah.
It was all this build-up around it. You know, Elland Road, there were all the, you know, the luminaries on the pitch beforehand, all the fireworks and stuff like that. And I think to come out of that game with a victory, which was a fairly scrappy victory as well, and a fairly scrappy goal scored by Calvin Phillips, I think that might have helped in terms of, you know, mentally for the players. I think it might have helped that they didn't fuck it up on such a big occasion, because that was probably the biggest occasion of the season so far. I mean, and it's nothing compared to that Swansea game towards the end of the season, but it is something, and it is overcoming a certain sense of pressure.
I think that's a really good point, Tom. I'd not even considered that.
I was going to say I have very little recollection of the Blackburn game, but I've just remembered I was actually there, which says a lot about it. But it was an interesting, it's certainly an interesting period. And I don't even really think, I don't know, it's not like I think about that 7-game winning streak as being like a big thing, because at the time it didn't feel like, I don't know, for some reason at the time it didn't feel very comfortable, and I'm not entirely sure why that was the case.
Yeah, I don't think it contained any of our very best performances, because even Middlesbrough game, Middlesbrough were awful, so
yeah.
I don't think you can really count that.
And then they came out of that and won like 4 or 5 on the trot, and Woodgang got manager of the month. What a funny season, funny season. But yeah, that is true. I mean, I was at the Blackburn game, and I remember you said that we were really strong for the first 60 minutes, and we'd come into that game, I think, after a series of results where we just didn't look very dangerous.
Yeah,
and I think we scored 2 goals quite early on in the Blackburn game, and it sort of felt, oh, you know, this could be like 3 or 4. And in the end, even though we came out 2-1 winners, it just sort of felt as though we hadn't really made the most of the situation. And I think maybe that period, to me at least, feels like there were situations like that, like the Luton game as well, where it sort of felt, however we look at it, it sort of did feel, because of that piece of commentary by the Luton commentator where he gets annoyed at a potential foul, and then on, I think it's Izzy Brown, isn't it? And then Bamford goes and scores. Even still, and then sort of scraping in another finish right at the end of that game through Bamford, it just sort of felt as though we weren't really deserving of our results. Same with Reading. Reading caused us a lot of problems, and we had that sort of breakaway goal from a corner where we ended up sort of flighting the ball in, a deflection from a Costa cross into Harrison's booming header. But even that, you know, it sort of felt like we'd sort of lucked out, and we didn't feel as though we were really playing as well as we had, but we were getting results. Same with the Huddersfield game as well, where we talked about where they pressed us really high and sort of the Gagan pressed us a lot, and we just didn't have anything to do with it really. And interestingly, like, no one did that for the rest of the season until Barnsley, and those were two of the results that we really struggled with. So
there's a couple of things just I thought I'd mention. The Huddersfield game was the first time we saw Ben White in midfield, wasn't it?
Oh yeah.
And and the whole game, I always bang on about this because I just thought it was extraordinary, but I thought Berardi's performance in that whole game was absolutely outstanding. He was marking Tom Eaves, who's a giant centre forward for Hull, and he was just kind of like scrabbling around at his feet but coming away with the ball every time. It looked like such a physical mismatch when you saw them the two of them stood next to each other, but Berardi had no problems with him at all. And I think in general the contribution to this season of Berardi has been a really positive one. He's never let the team down when he's come in. There's not been any red mist or any moments where he's had his, you know, his violent urges haven't really come to the fore this season. Well, they've not come to the fore at all. And that game to me felt like probably his best ever performance for Leeds. So I thought it's worth just highlighting that.
Yeah, and I'm a big fan of clean sheets, and we got a lot of clean sheets during this period.
Did you used to play as a central defender, Darren? I don't think you ever mentioned
that. I certainly did. But, you know, I love a clean sheet almost as much as I love to see 3 goals going in at the other end. So I was very happy during that period because we looked really defensively solid.
I'm just looking through now at the Cooper's injuries for the season. And he had basically, he was not playing in the Cardiff game, weirdly. But he, obviously was he was injured for the Huddersfield, Hull and Cardiff games. And then he had a three-game injury as well, Millwall, Birmingham and Preston. And then he was missing for the Stoke game as well. And that was when Berardi came in. But I do think it is good for you to point out that Berardi has been a revelation under Bielsa, really.
Yeah.
Again, I think that's probably because we have a series of central, or have had a series of central defenders who aren't particularly good at the sort of one-on-one, particularly when we talk about Cooper being done by balls over the top. But Berardi as well is can be positionally suspect and often will jump in because of... because he's sort of out of position and it often comes down to that. And I wonder how much Bielsa's system has actually... I mean, we know what it's done for Cooper, a high possession, positional-based system, which is actually reliant on man-marking, I think actually works quite well for someone like Cooper. And I think the same is probably true for Berardi as well. And yeah, it's going to be interesting to see. I had a long conversation yesterday with someone about whether or not John Stones would work in our system, because obviously... on the face of it, you kind of think, well, we don't want John Stones. But then on, there's always that possibility where you're like, well, Bielsa plays this sort of really weird system where the defenders basically man-mark. The weakest defender will usually just go one-on-one and the other will drop in behind. I wonder if that will work with John Stones.
I can see from Darren's face that he disagrees, but I would absolutely take John Stones. I think
Like,
we're not talking about a player who's been shit for, you know, a bottom of the table team. We're talking about a player who's not been quite good enough for Man City.
Yeah, but the mistakes he makes are the sort of mistakes that are going to put a team like ours right under the cosh,
They're also the sort of mistakes that Ben White would probably make in the Premier League as well.
Well, I'd ask me right now, and I'd much rather have Ben White than John Stones any day of the week. We're not going to have either of them in the end, so it's kind of academic. But no, keep John Stones as far away from Ellen Road as you can, please.
But see, that's my initial feeling as well. But then at the same time, I do kind of think, you know, Liam Cooper is doing like mistakes all the time like that before Bielsa came in, and I kind of feel like it's at least worth a gamble.
I'm with you, man.
It would be interesting if I wasn't a Leeds fan.
I'm not having it.
I must admit, I do have any time a player does things that are not what their position is supposed to do, I kind of instinctively like them. So it's I don't know if it's just me deliberately being awkward, but I always like the players that everyone thinks are a liability. Maybe we should sign David Luiz.
I'd rather have Luiz.
Right, has anyone got any other thoughts on this long period of successful incompetence, or whatever we're calling it? So it ends with the whole game, and then we go into Cardiff. And I mean, we've talked about Cardiff, but Darren, how much? Let's have your thoughts on how much of a turning point this was.
In hindsight, it was a massive turning point, wasn't it? There was a bit of a psychological collapse there. We'd not really conceded more than one goal in a game previous to that. But at the end of the Cardiff game, as I was walking out the stadium, I was just laughing. I just thought it was. I didn't anticipate anything like what the next 11 or 12 games were going to be like. I just felt it was one of those blips. We would get over it relatively quickly, that there were obvious individual errors contained therein that probably wouldn't happen again. Looking at you, Kiko Kassir. I had no idea what was about to happen. I thought we were just going to pick up where we'd left off, you know, in the previous games. But in hindsight, it was a massive turning point, which led to the most stressful part of the season, you know, by a long stretch. And by the time, you know, I know we're going to talk about it next time, but by the time we got to the Forest game, I was convinced that we were going to throw it away, end up finishing sixth. You know, the whole bit, the whole jungle instincts had kicked in, and I was a proper Leeds fan again. In that sense of kind of going, everything's going to go wrong. We're going to finish sixth, and Bielsa should fuck off. You know, and all that kind of stuff. Do you like my Leeds fan impression?
That's good. Sounds quite a lot like Johnny Vegas, weirdly.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah.
Monkey! Anyway. Yeah, Tom, what's your thoughts on the Cardiff game? I know you're someone who's a sort of iconoclast when it comes to standard narratives, so I'm sure you've got an interesting take on this.
I don't think I do, really. It was, I think it was made even worse by the fact that it wasn't just a 3-0 that we played about as well as we normally play. It was we were 3-0 up and playing probably the best football we played all season. We looked pretty imperious. And I think the sheer height that we dropped from made it seem even worse. I guess it's probably worth giving a mention to Pascal Struijk, who, you know, was... I don't know if he was made a scapegoat, really, because I don't think it would have been reasonable to make him a scapegoat. But he copped a bit of flack for his role after he came on and missed that header. And he's obviously come back and he's playing in midfield now and looks like he could be a real player for us next season. So it's probably worth mentioning his redemption story.
Mm. Yeah, I think yeah, we do. And I think that's, you know, that's really one of the most powerful ones. The fact that he did feel as though he'd let the team down and wanted to go back to the Eredivisie. But yeah, ended up coming through and playing in most of the last few games of the season and playing very well. So watch this space. It seems like we've got a new backup for the number six position. So there's another potential transfer that won't happen. Anyway, so yeah, we've gone through it in fairly granular detail there. Anyone want to sort of sum up how the first half of the season feels looking back on it now? So I'll give you both a chance to pontificate on it. But Darren, what's your takeaway from the first half of the season?
The overall, we were just about managing par for what I expected up to that point in the season. That because of that 7-game winning run where we didn't look spectacular, we'd got our points average up, which made up for some of the results where we played superbly at the start of the season and not managed to get the points we needed. So overall, I was kind of satisfied walking away from Cardiff going, yeah, you know, we're still in really good shape. That was, you know, we played great. Let's forget about that last 20 minutes. And yeah, overall, yeah, satisfied.
Just giving it a grade.
Great. What grade? What? I'll give it a, you know, an A-, B+, A-.
Okay. And Tom, how about you? You don't need to give a grade if you don't want.
No, please no. It just feels like looking back, it's just a lesson in what stress and tension can do to the body. Because as I was watching these games live, I feel like I was sweating and feeling awful for about 90% of the time I was watching. But then you look back and look at it objectively and you just realise that it was fine. It was nearly always fine.
So I think we've arrived at the end of the first part of our season review. Tune in next week to find out what happens in the second half of Leeds United season. Just a few bits of housekeeping. As always, do keep your eye on our Twitter feed. We put most of our stuff out through there, so if we've got any new content that's coming out, it will appear over there. At this point of the season, it would be great if you've enjoyed us, at least could head over to iTunes and give us a rate and review. And if you listen on any other podcast aggregator, I'm sure you can rate and review it on there as well. That would be great, just because it gives us a little bit more high profile when people search Leeds United podcasts or something like that. And then beyond that, if you love our content and you want to get more of it, we have a Patreon channel as well where we put out bonus content at the moment, and we're trying to put as much as we can out there at the moment, which is quite easy to do because obviously the transfer window is going well, in theory, quite quickly and strongly, but if you're a Leeds fan, that may not be quite the case, but not so much. So I put up a bonus episode this week. It's a podcast episode with Riccardo Marchioli, who is the guy who wrote that match. Well, that report of Leeds United under the Bielsa for the last 5 games, a really in-depth report, which is well worth reading. I spoke to him for about 45 minutes, just talking about the process of going through making a report like that and his thoughts on Bielsa and Leeds United, and looking forward to what Leeds might need to do differently tactically next season. So if that sounds interesting, head over to the Patreon there. We've also got a Joe Gelhart
scouting report over there as well that I cooked up this week. And we're going to do, hopefully, a scouting report a week over there. And also, if you are a patron, you can request us to put some data viz up over there. If there's anyone that you want to see their radar of, if you want to look at a team's, I don't know, average positions, map, or any of the graphics that we put out, if you do want to see those, do drop us a line if you're a patron, and we will put those up over there. So you can have data viz on tap. Three people who have done that this week, and I chose these people for a reason, because they're all called Andrew. Three people in a row signed up, all called Andrew, and you know, that's almost as remarkable as the season that Leeds have had. So we are going to change our name to All Andrews, Aren't We? And many thanks to Andrew Booth, Andrew Barwick, and Andrew Turner. If you're interested in the Patreon channel, if you head over to www.patreon.com/AllStatsAren'tWe, all of the information on how to sign up is over there. Oh, deep breath. So we've made it to the end of the podcast, and all that remains for me to do is to say thank you to Tom.
Thank you.
And thank you to Darren.
Thank you very much.
And we will be back next week with the second half of our Leeds United season review.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.